I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The Investigate Building 7 conference on March 26th was a great success. I'll be sharing the audio from it with you on future broadcasts. And I want to thank all of you who came to the day-long conference. Today you'll hear an interview with author David Ray Griffin that was first aired in April of 2010, prior to his speaking here in Connecticut in May of last year. David Ray Griffin suffered a stroke in the summer of 2010 and is still recovering. There was, in my opinion, a recent unjustified attack on parts of David Ray Griffin's writings on the website 911blogger.com that generated 400-plus responses. It's also my opinion that the attack involved cognitive infiltration of the 9/11 truth movement by paid infiltrators to try to knock down one of the most trusted leaders of the movement. I'm re-airing this interview to show my support and respect for David Ray Griffin. Dr. Griffin was a Nobel Peace Prize nominee in August 2008 and 2009. He was also ranked 41st by the New Statesman as one of the 50 people who matter today. He is a professor of philosophy of religion and theology, emeritus, Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University in Claremont, California, where he remains a co-director of the Center for Process Studies. Dr. Griffin has authored over 35 books, one of which, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, was a Publisher's Weekly Pick of the Week in 2008. Dr. Griffin has also been a guest on hundreds of radio shows and has been featured in major TV programs about 9/11 by the BBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and Japan's National Network. It's a real honor to speak with him today. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be back with you, Cheryl.
I'd like to just start sort of at the beginning with you, and maybe you could tell us when you first got interested in 9/11 and when you first started to doubt the official conspiracy theory.
This was back in early in 2003. We had just invaded Iraq, and I was asked by students at my school to make a presentation about that. What did I think about that? And it just happened at that time I had been reading for just about a couple weeks on 9/11. A half year earlier, a visiting professor was at the school, and one of my students said, "This guy says 9/11's an inside job." And I said, "Well, that's interesting." And she says, "You want to talk to him?" And I said, "Well, sure, I'll talk to him." So I talked to him, and he told me some things, and I said, "Well, that's plausible. I don't believe it." And I even said what people say to me now, and they say, "Oh, well, I don't think the Bush administration, even the Bush administration, would do something that bad. But show me the evidence." And he said, "Okay, I'll send you some websites to look at." And he did, and I looked at them, and I didn't find it convincing, and I went back to my other stuff I was working on. I was writing a book, actually, on the American Empire, and that's what I had started after 9/11, believing that this was blowback for American foreign policy, particularly in the Arab Muslim world. But in early 2003, somebody had sent me the complete 9/11 timeline that Paul Thompson had put out. And then, coincidentally, I had started reading a little book about war by Gore Vidal, and he had about three pages in there about a book by a guy named Nafiz Ahmed about 9/11, and I had read that. So I made my first presentation about Iraq and used 9/11 and said, "Well, I think Iraq is based on a false pretext." So that's how I got into it. And so here I am on this lecture tour going to speak about the other war that 9/11 supposedly justified, the one in Afghanistan.
Before we get to that, I'm just wondering, you've written, what, nine books on 9/11?
Believe it or not, yes.
Yes, and I'm just wondering what's motivated you to write so many and what keeps you going.
Well, of course, I had no idea of doing this at the beginning. If somebody said, "Well, you write one, you're going to end up writing nine," I probably wouldn't have done it. My wife certainly wouldn't have let me do it. But one thing leads to another. So I wrote The New Pearl Harbor, and that was simply a summary of the work that people who had woken up long before I did had already done. And I just summarized their work in a way that, you know, it was readable and could get published. And this book was published at the very beginning of 2004, and it was given to the 9/11 Commission. I know several people who sent copies to commissioners. A friend of mine, he was going back east, so he got on a red eye and took 10 copies and put them in on Lee Hamilton's desk because a friend of his was a friend of hers. So we know they had copies. I was very curious then when the 9/11 Commission report came out to see what they would do about all the stories in there that seemed to contradict the official story. Up till then, if you go back and read New Pearl Harbor, you'll see I didn't accuse the Bush administration of an inside job. The subtitle says Disturbing Questions. And in the book itself, I said, well, there's a prima facie evidence for Bush administration complicity in the attacks. But that's it, you know. And I said, you know, maybe the 9/11 Commission can answer all these questions. And that was back before I realized what the 9/11 Commission was, that it was being run by this guy named Philip Zelikow, who really was just a Bush White House insider. He was essentially a member of the administration and so on. And not knowing too much about the other commissioners, I had some hopes that at least some of them would keep them honest and they would do something. So when the commission report came out and I saw right on the first pages that they were just telling the story about the hijackers, even though some of them had shown up alive after 9/11, then I saw, and the more I read, I saw, well, it was a complete whitewash. So that motivated my second book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, because what I found was they simply omitted 99% of what we had found and distorted the other 1%. Well, then I gave a lecture that was called 9/11 and the American Empire at the University of Wisconsin, and this was televised by C-SPAN and played, and that was the first major exposure to the nation as a whole about these things. And people in the truth movement were watching it, and I saw their emails, and they said, I can't believe he's saying these things. He's saying these things on TV. And this really did help the growth of the truth movement. A lot of people have told me, you know, I got into the movement back when I heard your C-SPAN lecture. And so it created such a response that I thought, well, you know, we need to do something with this. So took that idea. And at that time, of course, people were saying, well, you know, it's just, there's nobody credible in the movement. It's just a bunch of kids on the internet and an aging theologian. And so I thought, well, you know, there are quite a few people. And so Peter Dale Scott and I contacted him, and we put together this book called 9/11 and American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. We edited it. We wrote to these people, got them to contribute chapters. And that did greatly increase the respectability of the movement because people saw there were other Americans, there were people in Europe who were rejecting the official story. And then, not to make this answer too long, but one other thing that happened simultaneously with that is I realized that the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement succeeded in large part insofar as they did because the churches got involved. People like, obviously, Martin Luther King and William Sloan Coffin. And a lot of churches got very active in both of these causes. And so I was hoping maybe we could do the same thing with 9/11. So I wrote my fourth book, Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11. And it didn't stimulate the kind of action that I was hoping for, but it also had some effect, and now we have one of the 10 professional organizations of 9/11 professionals who's called Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, and we have by now well over 100, and some of these are fairly prominent religious leaders. So, and then I'll give one more. In 2006, just before the fifth anniversary of 9/11, the defenders of the official story decided to counterattack, it looks like. Up till then, they had pretty much ignored us. But by then, they decided evidently they had to try to refute us. And so in August of 2006, just a month before 9/11, the fifth anniversary, you had four major publications out to debunk us and bolster the official story. And, of course, one of those was the Popular Mechanics book. They had taken their article and turned it into a book. And so that was the motivation for the next book, which was because Popular Mechanics in particular was claiming to have debunked the 9/11 truth movement. So I wrote this book called Debunking 9/11 Debunking, an answer to Popular Mechanics and other defenders of the official conspiracy theory. So that's what I mean. One thing led to another.
And in your 2008 book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, you state that once people actually examine the evidence, the fact that 9/11 was an inside job becomes pretty obvious. Could you speak to that?
Yes, and the motivation for that book is people kept saying to me, you've got to put out a new edition of The New Pearl Harbor. And I said, well, look, that book's way out of date. I've put out all these new books, Critique of the Commission Report and Debunking 9/11 Debunking and so on, and 9/11 Contradictions. And they said, yeah, but they're not The New Pearl Harbor. The New Pearl Harbor is the book. It's the Bible. It's the you've got to put out a new edition of that. Well, I didn't want to put out a new edition of that because, you know, it still serves a purpose. It still is the most readable of all the books. People will still say, well, you know, of all your books, I like that one the best. And, you know, that's sort of disappointing after all those other books. But nevertheless, it's just a fact. And it was written in a more readable way, I guess, than the later books, because I was just reporting what other people did. And so I didn't go into so much detail the way scholars tend to do, you know, with all our fancy footnotes and all that. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll write a companion volume. So that was The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, whereas The New Pearl Harbor itself brought people up to date as to what had occurred by the end of 2003. The New Pearl Harbor Revisited picks up the story from there and tells what happened during the next 4 years. And, of course, an enormous amount happened, so that book is quite a bit bigger than the first book. But as I've told people, if you only want to read two books, if you just get those two books, they'll give you pretty much everything you need. Now, that's not quite true because, in the meantime, NIST put out its report on World Trade Center 7, and that's a story unto itself, which demanded the next book, which is The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, why the final official report about 9/11 is unscientific and false. Maybe we can come back to that, but I'll respond a little more to your question. Yes, once you do look at the evidence, you see that all of the evidence for the official story simply falls apart. For example, I have a chapter in there on the hijackers and show that all the evidence that there were hijackers, Al-Qaeda hijackers on the planes, simply dissipates once you look at it. The passports they allegedly found at crash sites, the stories about those are just laughable. Then more seriously, the phone calls from the planes, which I had accepted for some time, but further investigation showed they really didn't happen. They couldn't have happened. The cell phone calls from high altitudes could not have happened. And stories were written by a scientist, one by an economist, explaining why those cell phone calls could not have occurred. In 2001, the technology didn't allow for high-altitude cell phone calls from airliners, 40,000 feet. Well, so lo and behold, now the FBI agrees with us. They have taken away all those high-altitude phone calls. Now they're telling us, all those were made on seatback phones. Only two calls that were when Flight 93 was about to crash down very low, only those were the cell phone calls. But most people still think, there were cell phone calls from the plane, so mainstream press won't tell everybody the stories of change. People still think that Barbara Olson made two phone calls to her husband, Ted Olson, the U.S. Solicitor General. He said, you know, there were two calls. The first one lasted about a minute. The second one lasted 2 or 3 minutes. The FBI report, when they, the same report that denies the cell phone calls, denies those calls. It says that Barbara Olson attempted one call. It was unconnected and therefore lasted 0 seconds. So here you have the FBI saying those calls didn't happen. Now go back to the cell phone calls. Dina Burnett said she got 3 or 4 calls from her husband, Tom Burnett, from Flight 93. She knew these were cell phone calls because she had her caller ID on and she recognized Tom's cell phone number. Now the FBI, and they recorded that, they reported her saying that right on 9/11 itself, so there's no problem of bad memory or making up something later or mishearing, you know. Now they tell us, well, no, Tom called on a feedback phone. Now think about that. How in the world, if he actually called on a regular feedback telephone, how in the world did his cell phone number show up on her caller ID? There you got about the strongest evidence you could want that these calls were just fabricated. They were faked. And there's the technology for doing that. Or maybe somebody was just on the ground and had Tom's call and faked the call from the ground. We don't know how they faked it, but it's a fake call. It didn't come from the plane. So that's one example of how all the evidence falls apart. But then, you know, if you really want the strongest possible evidence, scientific evidence, then you go to the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, and then particularly Building 7.
And that brings me to my next question. In your latest book, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Final Official Report About 9/11 is Unscientific and False, you state in talking about the NIST report that its authors have committed scientific fraud in the strict sense by ignoring, falsifying, and fabricating evidence. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. The National Science Foundation has a document laying out what counts as scientific fraud. There's one other type, plagiarism. They were not guilty of that, perhaps because nobody said anything stupid enough for them to want to plagiarize. But they were guilty big time of those three, omitting evidence, falsifying evidence, and outright fabricating evidence, just making it up. For example, they tell us that the World Trade Center 7 came down, brought down by fires, first time in history, a steel frame, high-rise building has been brought down by fires. And this was explainable because the girders, I won't get into the technical details, but you can read the book. These girders that connected the beams to the floors and the columns to the floors, they said those were not attached to the floor with shear studs. And so when you had a little problem, they just broke free, and that was part of the problem. Well, you go back to NIST's own report. NIST, of course, is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which was given the job of putting out these official reports. And you go back to the report they put out in 2004 called an interim report on World Trade Center 7. They said the beams and the girders were connected to the floors with shear studs. In this new document, they just quoted that paragraph almost word for word and just omitted the word and girders. So you can see right there, this is a lie. Likewise, they say, they tell such obvious lies. They said that the building was just really on fire, and particularly on the 12th floor, which they said floors 11, 12, and 13 were the crucial ones where the fires caused the building to come down. And on floor 12, this is, of course, a 47-story building, so, and you've got fires on at most 6 floors. So this is not a towering inferno. So they had to isolate, they had to say, well, it was this fire. So the fire on floor 12, they said, at 5 o'clock was just a huge, huge fire. They show you this with a graphic and have a fire, you know, this huge, huge flames on floor 12. Well, you look back at their 2004 interim report, and here's what you find. They said there were still fires on floors 8, 9, and 11 at 4:45, but The fire on floor 12 had completely burned out. So back then, before they developed their new theory, they did, and they showed a photograph. You could see in the photograph, no fire. And the fire is completely burned out by 4:45, and yet in this new report in 2008, they tell us at 5 o'clock, 15 minutes later, this fire is really going strong.
I understand that you're working on another book, and that should be out soon. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'm actually working on two. I'm working on one on the topic of my lecture, Afghanistan and 9/11, but more immediately, there's a book that has this rather strange title called Cognitive Infiltration. And the subtitle is An Obama Appointee's Plan to Undermine 9/11 Conspiracy Theory. And the person in question is Cass Sunstein. He's a very well-known lawyer. Law professor. He taught at the University of Chicago for a long time, at which time he got to know a young man named Barack Obama, who was teaching part-time at the University of Chicago Law School. Well, then Sunstein, in 2008, moved to Harvard Law School and co-authored a paper there with another Harvard professor named Adrian Vermeule called Conspiracy Theories. And in this paper, they argued, and they used 9/11 as their chief example, they argued that the government should try to undermine these false and harmful conspiracy theories, particularly this 9/11. And you can't do it in kind of the straightforward way. You can't just put out information and explain to people why it's wrong, because conspiracy theorists are such strange people. They don't believe anything coming from the government, and they're not very good at understanding evidence, and, well, they're just weird. They're kooky, you know. And so the only way he argued, and of course the truth is, they know they can't undermine it by argument because they don't have any arguments. We know that, but they're hoping to fool the public and convince. Anyway, so the only way we can do this is what's called cognitive infiltration. The thesis being that what's wrong with these conspiracy theorists is they live in their own little world with other conspiracy theorists, like-minded, in this case, 9/11 conspiracy theorists. This is a self-enclosed network. They're not exposed to the wide world of ideas, and so they suffer from cognitive impairment. They're cognitively crippled, is their term. And so they just don't have information. So what we need to do is open up and get some information to them. So we're going to bring in infiltrators. These are going to be government agents, often sent in anonymously, and they're going to infiltrate the movement cognitively. They're going to start introducing new ideas and questioning and, you know, try to break up these clusters, these movements. So that's the argument, and so my book takes it apart. I analyze the case he makes in 10 steps, and we have these chapters dealing with each of these theses.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. I can't wait to read that one.
By the way, let me mention this other book that I had mentioned in passing, the one called Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11. It had been kind of suffering in the doldrums in terms of book sales for a couple years now. Recently, however, I did an interview that has revitalized this book and brought it way up in the rankings on Amazon.com. This was an interview I did on a station, on a network that I had never heard of, and you may not have either, called God TV. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either. And when I first was contacted by him and said, the hosts of this show, Wendy and Rory Alec, would love to have you come to Washington, D.C. and interview. And I thought, what, God TV? And it's a show on apocalypse and the end times. And I thought, oh, no, thank you. So I told him no thank you, and I said, you know, they probably don't understand my theology. I'm a theologian, but my theology is so different from theirs. We would have nothing in common, so they surely wouldn't want to interview me. And he wrote back and he said, oh, yes, yes, they know all about your theology. And they know it's completely different from theirs, but they don't care. They're just interested in 9/11. They think you're right about 9/11. Well, I'm still very skeptical, but I went on and saw some of their shows, and they're just great kids. I call them kids because I'm 70, and they're about 40. So to me, they're kids. And they are just great, and they do a really, really good, casual, but very well-informed interview. And this is, in fact, the best TV interview I've ever done. Certainly in the United States, I've done a few good ones outside, but never a sit-down for 30 minutes interview where I was just allowed to tell the story with very intelligent questions. And so you can go on God TV, and you can find this show, Apocalypse and the End Times. Now you can see it available on 9/11 Blogger, and it'll be available on various places. But you can go directly to God TV and find the show, and you'll see it's really the best thing that I've been able to do in this country in terms of TV.
Wow, that's great.
And it really has brought this book back to life.
Well, that's fantastic. And I know you're doing the 15-city tour, and you're going to be stopping here in West Hartford on Friday, May 7th. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your tour. The title of it is The War in Afghanistan Justified by 9/11?
Yeah, this is, something we hoped we wouldn't have to be arguing with a new administration, but it turns out that the Obama administration is using 9/11 just as much or even more than the Bush administration to justify the war in Afghanistan and the extension of the war into Pakistan, so it's now quite often called the AFPAC War. Obama has said many, many times, why are we there? We're there because we were attacked by Muslim radicals on 9/11, and they did their planning in Afghanistan, and we've got to make sure they can't regroup and plan again. And, you know, it's very specious argumentation, not up to, Obama is a very bright fellow, and he must just cringe when he has to say these things, but he says them. So I'm making the argument that for anybody who really believes that the war is justified, that it was originally justified and is still justified by the 9/11 attacks, I give ample reasons, I think, why that's simply false.
And we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Okay, Cheryl. Well, thank you very much for the interview.
That was an interview with author David Ray Griffin that was done in April of 2010, prior to his speaking engagement here in May of 2010. And now I want to tell you about an anti-war demonstration that's going on Saturday, April 9th in New York City at Union Square at 12 noon. To find out more about it, you can go to the website www.nationalpeaceconference.org. That's nationalpeaceconference.org. Who's going to work to stop these illegal wars? The president? Congress? I don't think so. If not you, then who? This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.